Welcome to the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. This is Sherilyn Parsons, founder and director of the festival. Enjoy the conversation.
Welcome, everyone. My name is Tanika Seeley Thompson. I work with UC Berkeley Arts and Design, and I'm so happy to be here on their behalf to introduce this conversation today. At UC Berkeley Arts and Design, it has been our great pleasure to partner with the Bay Area Book Festival in sponsoring today's much anticipated session and many other events on the program. Berkeley Arts and Design is a campus-wide initiative led by the wonderful Shannon Jackson, who I'm sure many of you know. She's Associate Vice Chancellor for the Arts and Design at UC Berkeley. And our arts and design landscape is a rich context for creative experiment and one that is propelled by a historic mission and commitment to access and social impact. And I'm sure that today's conversation is indeed one of those moments of access and social impact. What I'm looking forward to and what I feel really very, very just so blessed and so fortunate to be here to witness is all these reminders that we need, I think, in this time of this imperative towards creative experiment and of the power of the imagination to help humans break free from confinement and indeed from some of the complications and limitations of language itself in that struggle. And so without further ado, it is my great pleasure to welcome distinguished, internationally renowned Kenyan author and a hero of mine, Professor Ngugi wa Thiong'o, who will be in conversation with another hero of mine from UC Berkeley, Zambian writer and our own professor of English, Dr. Namwali Serpell. I'll just take a moment to ask you, if you haven't turned off your cell phones or pagers, now to do so, and to please warmly welcome our guests to the stage.
Thank you. It's kind of
welcome. Thank you so much for that warm welcome, Tanika. I'm delighted and honored to welcome Professor Ngugi wa Thiong'o to the Bay Area Book Festival. Ngugi wa Thiong'o is a perennial favorite to win the Nobel Prize for Literature. And African writers like me have had to mark the day of the announcement of the Nobel Prize for Literature as a day of disappointment every year for at least the past decade. We hope that the prize committee will do better soon. Ngugi wa Thiong'o is a playwright, and he's published 7 novels: Weep Not Child, The River Between, Petals of Blood, A Grain of Wheat, Devil on the Cross, Matigari, and Wizard of the Crow. He's distinguished professor emeritus at UC Irvine, and is just as prolific a critic and nonfiction writer. His book, Decolonizing the Mind, The Politics of Language in African Literature, I signed copy here, published in 1986, is a classic of postcolonial theory, linguistics, diaspora studies, and political science. It essentially brought the term decolonizing into the sphere of the humanities, and this seed has recently blossomed again in global and largely successful efforts to decolonize the syllabus, which is of great interest to me, of course, as an English professor. And these efforts have ranged from Cape Town to Oxford to Yale, a resurgence of a concept that is as remarkable for its power as it is for its continued relevance in 2018, that we still need to decolonize our minds. Another major longstanding concept that we've had the benefit of learning from this book is linguicide, the idea that languages are often destroyed by imperialist powers. As early as 1967, in an interview at Leeds University, Ngugi wa Thiong'o was quoted as saying, "I have reached a point of crisis. I don't know if it is worth any longer writing in English." And within a few years, Professor wa Thiong'o had made the radical decision to write only in Kikuyu, a Kenyan language. This required that he translate his own novels into English, and he has thus become both an expert practitioner and theorist of translation. He's recently embarked on a new, I'd say, linked series of nonfiction memoirs, Dreams in a Time of War, a childhood memoir, which came out in 2010, and The House of the Interpreter, a memoir in 2012, Birth of a Dreamweaver, a memoir of a writer's awakening in 2016, and now Wrestling with the Devil, the occasion for our conversation today. Wrestling with the Devil is a new edition of a work called Detained, a writer's prison diary, which was published in 1981, and which describes his time as a political prisoner in 1977. So I thought we could start our conversation with a reading from Professor Wationgo about why and how he was arrested in 1977.
Let me start by saying I'm very glad to see all of you here. Amazing. Let me also start by introducing my wife, Jerua Goge. She's sitting over there. She describes herself as both my wife, then I too. When she says, I add quickly, and my director. Because she does, I do so in the family, but also she's also the director of the Center for Conflict Resolution at the University of California, Irvine. So in that sense, she's doubly my director. That's here. Also, let me just say how glad I'm, you know, to see Sapel here. I think this is the first time we are meeting, last night.
Yes.
I've been longing to meet her. Because he did a brilliant, rarely does a writer come across an introduction to his work, which the writer likes reading in its own right. And this is what she did when she did the Penguin, asked her to do an introduction to the book Devil on the Cross. So much so that when my literary agent, Gloria Loomis, New York, read the introduction, She said, I would like to represent her. If she doesn't. Now, if you know Gloria, she doesn't actually accept. She really accepts sort of representation because she is so much. And she's extremely selective. But she was offering. She was saying, I would like to represent her. Yeah, because the quality of that piece. And later, what she wrote about the same in the New York Times here. So, but I met her for the first time last night. And also to understand, she's also really, I've not read your short stories, but I'm going to read your short stories, you know, as well. Yeah, so she combines all these elements. So now, I don't know where to start exactly, because by reading, but you touched something. First of all, first just to correct, sort of, I'm not actually emeritus, although I got the hint. I'm still distinguished, active distinguished professor.
Sorry.
And actually teaching and so on. But, you know, since I turned 80 in January, people have been asking me, are you still teaching? Or something like that? And I know, but when you say emeritus, I thought, okay, it is merit.
Yes.
You know, a distinguished professor by merit.
Yes.
Just one very quick story I want to tell, arising from your introduction. You quoted a passage from an interview I had in Leeds in 1965, I think.
67.
67, thereabout, you know. Actually, that's a very important moment in my life, and I might as well start with that one, because it's the one which led me to eventually to prison, in a way. And I can still actually started in New York, of all places, because New York, I came to New York for the first time in 1966, during the International Pen Conference, when Arthur Miller was the president. I was invited as on account of my two novels, which I had just published, Weep Not Child, The River Between. I was a regional guest from Africa, and so on. It's a very big conference because it's supposed to overcome the Cold War divide between East and West. So there are many writers, you know, who are formerly from communist countries, and there are others like Pablo Neruda from Chile, who had not been allowed into the country because he used to be a member of the Chilean Communist Party. But they were all there. So it was a very important, you know, conference. And I was a young writer, enjoying it. And you know how it is, I'm a young writer, invited there, I'm trying to look the writer, you know. How does a writer sit in a conference? Do they sit like that? Or do they, you know? So I tried different poses throughout the conference. All right, you know. Until the last session, I think Pablo Neruda Ada Miller was presiding over that particular session, and there was a writer from Italy, Sloan, he wrote a famous novel called Bread and Wine. Sloan, S-L-O-N-E, and another name, Sloan. Anyway, it will come to mind. Now, remember, I'm posing, very important. You must really, you know, some enjoy my poses, listening keenly. So I'm not quite hearing exactly what's going on. until I hear something, he's talking about translations from Italian into English, and he's saying that there are very few translations. He's complaining about the fact there were so few translations of modern Italian literature into English. And then he said, and you know, Italian is not like one of these Bantu languages with one or two words in their vocabulary. Ooh. My poses became a warrior. Now I have to defend the dignity of African languages. They've been attacked. I'm representing Africa. So I stand up. Poses and all poses, no posing no anymore. To defend the right of African languages and all that. And Ada Miller, I remember him being very diplomatic. He said it was not, you can praise your own languages, but you don't bring down other people's languages, you know. So I really appreciated that intervention. And then I go on a tour of the States, and then through Iowa, writer's place. And then, anyway, I returned to Leeds, where I was doing some postgraduate work in Caribbean literature. And I'm in the middle of writing the novel, A Grain of Wheat. And guess in what language I'm writing it. It's not in one of those Bantu languages whose vocabulary I was defending as being equal to any other. I'm writing in English. And so that interview came soon after that. Yeah. It was really a genuine crisis I was going through, you know. I didn't know even whether I wanted to finish the novel, A Grain of Wheat, or not, you know. But it's a very important, I'm glad you mentioned it, because it's very important. And you can argue that in some ways it may have eventually led me into prison. Because what led me to prison eventually in 1976, 77, was the fact that I had written a play in a Gikuyu language, which was being performed by owner working people in the village. I was then professor of literature at Nairobi University, published novelist, four novels, I think. But now I'm doing something which has not been done before, writing a play in Igbo language and being performed, most important, being performed by factory workers, plantation workers, landless, you know, unemployed, you know, the the marginalized of society, if you like, and very successful. And on November 11, it was stopped, or 16, thereabout. And then 3 months later, or the next month, I'm taken to, well, let me read. Okay. The police come to my house at midnight. They are all armed. Okay, they surround my house. And they say they are taking me to Tigoni. Yeah. This was an abduction. Still, as they drove me, I couldn't help musing over the fact that the police squadron was armed to the teeth to abduct a writer whose only acts of violent resistance were safely between the hard and soft covers of books. Tigoni was the local police station, that's where they took me, about 6 miles away. I was pushed into an empty room with bare walls where I was guarded by only one member of the abducting team. Now he smiled rather slyly and asked me, "How come that as soon as we knocked at the door, you were already up and fully dressed?" Which was actually true. I had neither the time nor the necessary energy to tell him that I had had a premonition that I had just returned home from Nairobi after saying a rather elaborate farewell to my drink buddies in Nairobi, that had even firmly and repeatedly refused a beer, or what they call a beer for the road, that had driven from Nairobi to Limuru at a snail's pace, literally no more than 25 miles per hour the whole way, that on arrival home, instead of putting on my pajamas and sit bed beside my wife, I just lay on the cover fully clad, staring at the ceiling and turning over the recent events since the public performances of my play Gaika Deda, since it had been burned, and that when I heard the knocking at the door and put on my shoes and went to the window and saw uniformed police officers, I felt as if I had been expecting the scene all along. This I could not tell him, even if I had the necessary energy or desire, because a few seconds after his query, some other police came for me, put me in another car, and drove me away. These were not among the ones who arrested me, and they didn't utter a word to me or to each other. It was only after what seemed an eternity that we reached another police station, Kiambu. Again, the same ritual, into an empty room in silence. They leave, and I hear them lock the door from the outside. Well, I was not alone for very long. A tall, slim man came in and, still standing, staring straight ahead, almost past me, made the formal announcement. "I'm Superintendent Boro, attached to Kiambu Police Station, and I'm under instructions to arrest and place you in detention. Have you anything to say?" The whole exercise, executed in an emotionless tone, had a slightly comic side. So between Limuru, my home, and Kiambu Police Station, I was not really under police arrest. "Do your duty," was all I said. He did not handcuff me. As he walked me toward a yellow Volvo not marked with the police colors, an onlooker would have thought that he and I were actually old friends. Boro, the officer, drove. I sat in the passenger seat next to him. I'm almost relaxed at the respite from the show of armed terror. He even started a conversation. "Oh, did your family originally come from the Rift Valley?" he asked me. "No," I said. "Oh, I've had that impression from reading your books." "Oh, I only write about it," I said. It was so casual, so ordinary, that it felt as if the officer was only giving me a lift to Nairobi instead of taking me to an unknown destination. Then the ordinariness of the situation began to disturb me. He and I were alone in the car. Though in civilian clothes, he was still a police officer, an agent of the state. He was armed. It was night, and there was no other vehicles on the road. Suddenly, what had once happened to Josiah Mwangi Kariuki crossed my mind. On March 2nd, 1975, J.M., a prominent popular nationalist, was taken by police from a Nairobi hotel in daytime, and his body was later found mutilated in Gong Forest. Could he, the officer, be on a similar mission for me? You see, my wife knew only that I had been taken by Tigon police. The Tigon police knew only that they had herded me into the Kiambu police. And the police who brought me to Kiambu hadn't even seen the officer walk me to the car. The breaks in the chain of custody began to seem eerily sinister. None of those in that chain could ever tell more than they knew. And now there was no eyewitness to anything that might happen to me. All right.
These premonitions that you had, this sense that this was coming, you mention in the book that you had written a short story as a young man that began, and this is a quote, "The thing that one remembers most about prison is the smell of shit and urine, the smell of human sweat and breath." And in the book, you give credit to your younger self for having such perspicuity. But then you note that as an actual prisoner, 15 odd years later, you had actually adjusted to that smell. You no longer smelled it. So this was something that your younger self had not imagined, that mm-hmm. the smell actually goes away. And another point, you note that you'd always found the idea of toilet paper manuscripts romantic and unreal until you found yourself in prison and desperate for toilet paper to write on.
Right.
And so I'd love to hear more about the ways in which your actual experience disillusioned you about what it was like to be in prison.
First of all, so when I was writing that short story as a young person, I was a student at Makerere, but now come to think of it, I did have an experience of 2 weeks in a police custody, and which I've described this in my memoir, in the house of the interpreter, when I was arrested, and accused literally of nothing. So the police had to keep on inventing facts and fiction. And I had to defend myself in a court of law, and I had never been in a court of law in my life. So maybe that sense of smell may have come from...
from that experience.
Yeah, but when I went to committee, Maxwell Security Prison, it's true. It was stinking. Every stank, and I would, "Oh my God, how am I going to adjust to this thing?" You know, right? And then, about 3 weeks or 2 weeks later, suddenly, I don't sense any smell anywhere. And I was, "What has happened?" Of course, it didn't realize I was thinking like the rest of the people. Yeah, you're asking about
television. Just what were the experiences? What was it actually like in committee?
Yeah, it was. As I said, I've tried to describe this in my memoir, which resonated with the devil, because those conditions, in some ways, I use the word devil here in many ways. One of the ways in which I use the devil here is because I wrote my novel, Devil on the Cross, in prison. So wrestling with the devil is like wrestling with the devil of the cross. Okay? Right, you know. But the conditions there in prison were also very devilish in so many ways, as well as what I thought the devils had put in that prison anyway. So anyway, so the conditions are really very, very challenging, you know, sort of, it's humiliation in every possible way. But one of the humiliations I found, I don't know if others find the same thing, but the sense of agency taken from you, that even when you go to the bathroom, people to watch you, you know, when you're asleep, there's somebody watching you, right? I found myself doing silly things like we were not allowed to have any sharp weapon like laser, you know, in case you might oppress him, hurt yourself or whatever, you know. And for some reason, I found myself hiding a laser, not for anything, just to kind of tell myself I can take care of myself. I'm accountable to myself. Just a sense of I'm accountable. You can't take this away from me. Mm. Yeah, right? Yeah. So that I found very hard initially, you know, until, of course, I started writing the novel to claim my agency, literally. Yeah.
Can you talk more about that? What was it about writing that felt necessary to maintain your sense of dignity and agency?
Yeah. Perhaps maybe I might answer this by reading that passage.
Sure.
Which we, where was it?
And page 179.
Yeah. I want to, when I go to prison, first of all, it's maximum security prison. I must emphasize this. It's the biggest prison in Kenya. It's a long history because many of the people who had fought for liberation, including my old brother, had been, including my brother's wife, they were imprisoned in that committee prison. It's got this history. And I am there. Then when I'm put there, I think there are 15 other political prisoners, and they are not allowed to speak to me. It's what they call internal segregation, meaning you're not put in an isolation cell by yourself, but the people around you cannot speak to them. They cannot speak to you, and you cannot speak to them. And it's very, it's like you feel as if you are, I don't know, it's like, it's horrible feeling. You're with people, they can't speak to you, you know, and you can't speak to them, and they're around you, okay? But the prisoners themselves have become very smart, although initially I did not understand why two of them, a few feet from me, from whatever the distance allowed, they would start giving each other instructions, advice on how to cope with prison. And I was thinking, why are they, what's wrong with this? So they are telling each other how to cope with prison, and they have been here already. Then I realized they were telling me, they were talking to me, right, through, without breaking any law, yeah. So, now, amidst this, who should turn up when I need human company? No matter what we say, we do need human company as human beings. Individualism, is wonderful when you know there's company. But not when you're forced into it. So, who should turn up but the priest, the prison chaplain, and No, didn't ring a bell when he called in. He just came in without announcing, right? Yeah. Now, he had two very big Bibles, staggering. Well, I'm exaggerating, but they were really big, the two Bibles. And he started telling me about how to, you know, about repentance and, so, what, and I was saying, but what, I've done nothing wrong. I wrote a play with peasants and working people in my language, and he has telling me not to repent. Anyway, I start arguing with him. What he did not know is that I had read the Bible quite well as a young person. So he would quote a passage which is proving one way, and I go to the same Bible and quote another passage proving the exact opposite. Right? So we went on this and this and this, and then he was a bit tired. He said, "You educated people, you argue too much. But remember, you can never argue your way to heaven." So he left me. Now, but I keep on, when I'm in prison, I keep on thinking about that argument. My argument with the Reverend keeps on coming back to me. I grew up with the Bible, mostly in the Old Testament, and most of the characters, Abraham, Isaac, David, Joseph, were my early companions in my village. This was because when I learned to read and write, the only book readily available was the Kikuyu language, Old Testament. I enjoyed some really magical moments. And the Bible is really, people talk magical realism as beginning with Latin American literature, but actually you need real magical realism. Please read the Old Testament. Or Mahabharata, actually, come to think of it. Yeah. See, for instance, Jonah surviving 3 days in the belly of a fish. You know, in the belly of a fish, and you survive 3 days, you come out happily. Right? Maybe with the smell of a fish a little bit, but you come out. Remember also Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego surviving fiery flames, and they come out not a single thing. Their clothes intact. But this may sound, this is very important for a political prisoner, because they are a symbol of, oh my God, you might also get out of this thing without, right, yeah. So it is the survival part that's most appealing, okay. But I also resent, you know, when you sort of keep it there, you ask the prisoners, what's happening outside? It's raining, no, they don't tell you anything, okay? So I keep on thinking, birds fly far above the walls of the prison. I wish they could lend me their wings just for a day. What would I do with them? Visit my family, my village, but also what? Oh, yes. Go to all the houses and offices of those in power, making mischief, or land at caves where they are planning corruption, and scatter their plates and knives, you know, some kind of practical jokes, and then back. Oh, no, I won't come back to this prison. I will not come back to this confinement. But the fun is in going, making mischief, and coming back at will, and enjoying their foolishness in thinking they can confine me within their man-made walls. But wait, this going and coming back is what I actually do night and day. I visit my family. I walk the streets. My imagination is my wings of glory. So a novel, that's what I must do. In Gikuyu, that would be fun. Writing a novel in the language that made them bring me here. Yes, combine fun with fight and flight. But no story would form. See, for instance, I need paper, pen, writing material. The warders have plenty. I want to write something, I tell them, hinting, it might even be a confession. The older political prisoners had told me the trick. It always works, they had told me. Because that's what they want us to do, confess. And indeed, the chief warder readily complies. A ballpoint, but only for a few sheets. Oh, never mind. I can supplement paper with, well, she talked about it, toilet paper. Good. The idea eludes, but the idea of a novel still eludes me. But soon another idea steals my sleep. It begins to form a shape around a competition among wealthy robbers. Jesus, I'm still thinking. You see me pause. I'm still thinking. Jesus and the devil come back to my mind. I still wrestle with my arguments with the Reverend. The idea that it was the devil and not Christ who should have been executed on the cross plays my mind. You see, Jesus was an opponent of Roman imperialism, a proponent of the kingdom of the least among us, a visionary who saw the poor among whom he walked as inheriting the earth. The devil was an ally of Roman imperialism and its oppressive practices, a self-serving criminal whose followers, exploiters of the poor, have as much chance of entering heaven as a camel through the eye of the needle. I know. A competition of modern robbers organized by the devil. But still the story refuses to form. And then one day something happened. Let me explain this. Among the warders, some of them were Kikuyu language speakers. Okay? And remember, these are the warders who are not in any way allowed to tell us, even whether it's raining outside or sunshine. But for some reason, one day, this warder begins to attack me as if I'm representative of the ruling elite. And he is, it's a complete reversal. I don't know how to explain. Let me just read this, because he comes to me and because he can't talk about sunshine or rain, he attacks me, not physically. The trouble with you educated people is you despise your languages. You don't like talking to ordinary people like me. But what use is your education if it cannot be shared with your own people? Let me tell you. You may possess all the book education in the world, but it's we, ordinary people, in tattered clothes, with bare feet and blistered hands, who have the real knowledge of things. Okay? Have you ever seen any European calling himself Mutiso, Kamau, Onyango, Kiplagat, or Simiyu? Have you seen Europeans abandoning their languages and bothering about our languages? Let me tell you something else. Yes, I may not have the book knowledge, but even a child can give you a word that might benefit you. You people, even if you follow Europeans to the grave, they'll never, never let you really know their languages. They'll never, and mark my word, don't look down upon a drawer lane. Europeans will never let you into the secrets or held in their language. What do you then become? They are slaves. And you know, he goes on and on. I would read the whole thing. You can read it from Interaction with the Devil. And but I'm thinking, does he not realize I'm here precisely for writing in the core language? You know, but my thinking is, I don't think he believes I was here because of the language issue. I think he believes something else, right? But I'm thinking, does not know that what he is saying could actually land him in this very prison if he was put in practice, you know. So I cannot really answer him. I'm each to tell him about Camille's experiment, but I know that if I do so much and mention the name Camille and the play, he'll freeze in terror, change the subject, and move away from the door of cell 16, which was my cell. But his talk has tanged me in ways that he'll never know. That night, I sit at the desk and start the story of Waringa, the heroine of the novel, the one called Waringa, in the Gikuyu language. I don't know how, but the idea of a competition of robbers organized by the devil becomes central to Waringa's adventures. It flows just like that. And for the first time since my incarceration, I feel transports of joy. That which I've always toyed with but feared, writing a novel in Gikuyu, my mother tongue, is happening before my own eyes. And I have government toilet paper for writing material and a government paid order as a consultant. Thank you.
So the novel that emerged from your time in prison is, it's a brilliant novel. You should all read it if you haven't already. And in my introduction to it, I noticed that there is a lot of interest in overturning certain kinds of corruption in what you call the neo-colonial regime in Kenya. And politics has always been really important to your writing. And we've heard now a kind of testament to how it saved you. Actually, writing was helping you survive your conditions. But I'm wondering, do you think there's still a role for literature to forge revolution?
Yes, not in the sort of, I think people don't read a novel and then they go in the streets saying, revolution, you know, I mean, otherwise it'd be very easy,
Yeah.
You know, writer, I don't know how many novels I would write and there would be revolutions everywhere. Mm. I think I like putting writing in the context of imagination. In my recent talk, or even in this memoir, Rest with the Devil, I talk a lot about imagination. Because I realize, I still do, actually even more so today than before, imagination is the greatest democratic equalizer. Mm. Right, you know. And imagination is actually, in some ways, is what makes us human. You know, by this I mean, imagine the things we do as human beings. We first picture them in the head before we realize, in fact, like the guy or people who devised this building we are in, they first imagined it, then put it on paper, and then builders came and put it into practice. You know, imagination makes us have visions of the future. You know, even the future which is not here with us, we imagine possibilities. You know, with imagination, we even imagine what heaven or hell be like, it makes us, so I come to this realization that oppressive regimes everywhere, all over the world and in history, they try and they want people to believe that they have the best of all possible worlds. You know, that's what Voltaire's Candide. We're the best of all possible worlds. In every, even as a slave, even plantation slave owners, they used to say, this is the best of all possible worlds, you know. And some of them couldn't imagine why the enslaved were running away. They couldn't, what's wrong with these people, you know? This is the best of all possible worlds, you know. So that idea that we have arrived at the best, you know, to limit the capacity of a people to shrink their capacity to imagine is what I mean. They don't want people to imagine possibilities at all. So they limit that space. That's why I think works of imagination, I can't realize, have always been, seems to be a threat to oppressive societies. Even go to the Bible, remember the prophets, Isaiah and others. What do they have? Words, right? Nothing else. There's John the Baptist who used to eat pick berries in the desert, and they had to execute him. Why? Because the words that incite imagination, possibilities, and so on. And I think literature for me, and music, and sculpture, and other things, art in general, nourishes the imagination. It's art is a product of imagination, of course, but it also nourishes the imagination. And so when people fight to diminish humanities and so on, they are attacking at the heart of what is human, really. You know, imagination is very important. That's how I look at the novel, you know, as part of the arts which help nourish the imagination, and is very important. However, imagination also makes us see links between things. Again, so important. Sometimes we are taught to believe that there's no correlation between wealth and poverty. As if there are two categories that have no meeting point, you know. They make us want to believe that there is no connection between economics, politics, culture, and psychology, you know. But maybe they are connected, okay? You know, the organization of wealth in society, the organization of power in society, the affect the organization of values in society, and how those values are organized also affect our psychic, whatever sense, you know. So they're connected. And as a novelist, an artist, I try and see the connection, you know. Because even like, well, there's no love for even two people meet. I mean, all of you are here, I'm sure, at one time you have had your heart beating when you met somebody. And you say, this is the one. Okay. But when you come to think of it, how you came to meet, the conditions at which you met, and everything play into that as well. Okay? Yeah, so they are connected. And for me as an artist, and I believe all art, even when artists say, no, I don't talk politics, you know. No, you read their works, and you see the connections they are making. Yeah.
It's pretty remarkable that you managed to write this book under these conditions. And, you know, there's this heart-stopping moment where the toilet paper manuscript gets taken away.
And
could you talk a little bit about that?
In the Read memoir, I have talked about there's a chapter I call Sherlock Holmes and the case of the missing novel. This is because, okay, let me try to explain to you. The toilet paper, and there's an example of toilet paper. I've reproduced a piece of it, yeah. This one, yeah. As you can see, it's square in shape, like the page of a paper, and the toilet paper was not as soft. You know, he's on television. have you seen on television those, I think, there's cartoons, I think bears, and
yeah,
their babies.
Yeah.
They wore those soft rolling, huh? Right?
Yeah.
No, not exactly.
But very good for writing, right?
Yeah.
To have the hard.
My hours was a bit hard. A little bit, you know. I think men to punish prisoners, I believe, you know. Mm. You don't want to make life easy, soft for prisoners. You make it a bit hard, you know. But it was really good writing material. It held the pen, you know, very well.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about...
And by the way, when you're writing, the moment I realized it became, I don't know how to put it, I know that I have captured this very well in the memoir itself, but for me it was survival. It was, not survival, resistance, you know. Because I realized early on that if you don't resist, resistance becomes very important. If I don't resist, if I say yes to something evil, you know, then I'm lost forever, okay? Mm-hmm. And for me, resistance need not take the form of physical altercation or anything like that, you know. But it can be sort of, you know, you say it's really even to yourself, no, this is not right, you know. Yeah, so for me, writing this novel on toilet paper, actually, come to think of it, have you seen presidents? I don't know why they do it here, although, but, you know, presidents, and they have motorcades, right? They are watched every night and day, okay? You know, all presidents, you know, all over the world, you know, more or less, you know. And here, the same thing was happening to me. I have guards all night long. You know, I'm served, food is given to me, already cooked, although not the best food in the world. Not like the one my wife makes for me, but... Right, you know. But anyway, the key thing is resistance. Becomes very, very important. So I was enjoying, in a way... almost like vicarious kind of pleasure. I'm writing a novel in prison in the very language which was the basis of my incarceration. You know, and I'm writing using the paper you are giving me, although it's meant for toilet paper, and every night there's a guard watching me, right? But that sense... it was kind of pleasure, I have to say, about that. So it was eventually captured. Okay, I'm writing on toilet paper, so what happens? We only allowed one bundle of toilet paper like this, or two. But mine was piling up. So eventually there was a search of our rooms, and my novel, the entire thing, was captured and taken to custody far from me. But I think you have to read the novel.
Yeah, to find out how it got recovered.
Yeah, Wrestling with the Devil. The memoir. You'll find out. It's in a chapter called Sherlock Holmes and the Case of the Missing Novel. Right, okay,
You talk about the need to resist, to survive and to resist, and the memoir includes an analysis of the history of political detainment in Kenya, beginning with the colonial period. It's fascinating connections that you draw between how colonial oppression kind of maintains in this new regime. And you talk about the you know, two different fates for political prisoners in Kenya. Some of them succumb to the degradation, and some of them resist. And so I'm wondering if you could talk about why you think it, for some people, it becomes a you know, their political mm-hmm. convictions collapse, mm-hmm. and for other people, they survive, they resist, mm-hmm. you know.
I think that comes at one moment. First of all, I don't think one can tell beforehand how they are going to survive these conditions.
Yeah.
So I do not want to say in any way that this is how, that I had thought through everything, that I thought when I go there, what I'll do. No, it's not like that at all. So nobody can tell. So I hesitate to judge people. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was very important to have seen my own political detention and imprisonment without trial in a context of Kenyan history.
Yes.
Because when you come to think of it, the president who imprisoned me, Jomo Kenyatta, our first president, did not know me. I met him briefly once, but as a journalist, he did not know me. His vice president, Daniel Arap Moi, who later became the dictator, did not know me personally. Yeah. So we can argue there was really, really nothing personal in their taking me to prison. In other words, it's not as if they and I had quarreled over property or anything of the sort, you know. Yeah. You know, there was really nothing personal mm-hmm. about this. So I had to react to, how did we come to be in this position? Is a question that kept on arising in my head. So I didn't want to dwell too much on my own tribulations all the time, you know. But I want to put my own story in the context of Kenyan history, you know. And if I was doing it now, I'd even try to put it in the context of world history, you know. When you see things in that perspective, something can be very, for me, I found it helpful.
Yeah.
You know, these historical characters in Kenyan history who either survived or said no, mm-hmm. okay, to similar conditions, yeah. So I spent a lot of time in the memoir, almost like thinking aloud about what I call in the memoir the culture of silence and fear, mm-hmm. you know. Mm-hmm. How does it come to be, you know? And people are coming to a culture of silence and fear is a very real thing. It can happen anywhere. You know, people are coming to a culture of silence and fear. Yeah.
So you've lived in the U.S. for quite some time, and I'm wondering if you have thoughts about the connection between the imprisonment that you experienced and the way mass incarceration works here. When you're thinking about these contexts, is there resonance there?
I don't know much about the history of this country, but sometimes, like, I believe you describe the conditions in your own home very concretely. Mm. People may see parallels.
Yes.
For instance, one of the things which I remember, argument we had in prison, I don't talk about it here, but I was found very interesting. When Daniel Arap Moi replaced Jomo Kenyatta as the president, I remember this argument in prison, because as people say, and later when we came out, people say, oh, he's just a passing cloud, okay? Mm. This man, he doesn't read books, you know? He doesn't read books, you know? He makes roadside declarations impromptu. There's not a single minister he dismissed without having to humiliate him first. Mm-hmm. All his humiliation was part of every single dismissal, you know. Mm-hmm. For instance, he'd be talking with a minister in his cabinet and be planning what, you know, and the minister would come out of it very happily. They are together with the president. He goes to his office. He found instructions have been given to his subordinate to lock him out. He hears on the radio as he's going to his office. He'll be saying, no, this must be a joke, something. No, it's not. I've just been to the president, you know. So, but what I remember is people saying he's a fool, he was a clown, you know, he passing cloud, you know, all sorts of things. And the reason I remember this is because, you know, I remember arguing with my other political prisoner. I said, no. And even later when I came out, this man, please, please, he is not a fool. And you shall be making mistakes if you take him for a fool. He is not a fool. He's not a fool, okay? That's what I remember. And what I remember, because he was in power for 23 years. Mm. Went through 23 years of reign of terror, you know, literally. And he forced me into exile, right? Yeah. So I think you, when they read my, you can see, if you do, I think a work of art, even as a memoir, if it works well, it's when it reminds people of parallels, when they can tell, oh, this is different, but it looks like me, oh, this is like what I know, and so on. Yeah. So I really hope that people, when they read Wrestling with the Devil, they look for the devil they have to wrestle with in their daily lives.
We have our own devils to wrestle with. I think we can open up for some questions from the audience. I'm not sure where the microphone bearer is. Okay. So if you just raise your hand. Oh, there's someone over here.
Hi, thank you so much for coming and talking and sharing your story. I wanted to know if you still have the complete original toilet paper manuscripts, and if you do, where do you keep it? And also, where did you keep it in prison?
Oh, well, the prison, but when I came out, actually, I had to move a lot of things, because soon after that, I was forced into exile. I happened, then my things, you know, so I've lost most of it. But fortunately, a few chapters still remain, and now they are being held by Indiana University. They bought my archives, so it's the toilet paper, the novel is actually now in Indiana. I don't know when they are going to make them officially available, but it's there. What was the next question?
Where did you keep it when you were in the committee?
Now, I can remember the Sherlock Holmes and the case of the missing novel. But I'll tell you the first part of it. I thought there was nowhere to hide it. You know, so I thought the best of hiding is by not hiding it. So what I did was, remember I'm telling them I'm writing a confession, okay? An endless confession, kind of thing goes on every day. When I wrote the officially given piece of paper, I put them on top of my desk. Okay, so they were narrow desk, but put somewhere there. And when I'm writing, you know, you keep on revising, discarding, because I would read by hand, not computers, by the way. We didn't have computers in those days, you know, writing. Then the piece of paper which I discarded, I put them on the table. I see this is what I was writing, okay, openly. But the others, since they were abandoned, they were abandoned like this one, just like this. If you look at this, and there are some writings here, but if you look at from this angle, you don't see anything, right? So if you write and make sure that the real ones are inside, and you make sure that the top three, nothing is written on them, and then put them back exactly the way they were and so on, they look as if they are an unused bundle of toilet paper. Mm-hmm. So in fact, when they arrested the novel, they were more, I don't think they thought they were arresting the novel. They thought they were taking away the piles of toilet paper. right? Right? Yeah. So I was hiding it by not hiding it. There's really nowhere to hide it. Yeah. Except not hiding it. Yeah. Right?
It's a remarkable fact that you actually had a novel arrested. When you wrote Matigari, they put out a warrant for Matigari, the fictional character. And when they discovered that it was a fictional character, they banned the book.
Yeah.
But it's pretty remarkable, you know. But the book had, this character is so charismatic and that he actually came to life and was arrested.
He, actually this is a very, no, this is a novel again. Okay, when I let me just contextualize this quite quickly. I left a prison in December 1978, not allowed to get any jobs. My job at the University of Nairobi was mysteriously disappeared, and whenever I went to ask for a job, whatever it is, no job available for me. I mean, the word had been sort of passed out that I'm unemployable. I went back to the village, worked some more, tried to revive the theater. We wrote another play in Gikuyu called Mother Sing For Me. It has not been published yet. Mother Sing For Me. This one was, we're going to perform it at the National Theater. No, we were locked out. Then later the police came to the village and razed the entire open air theater to the ground. I mean, so many things happened. And thereafter, I myself am forced into exile, say from 1982 to 23 years later. Okay. Now, when I'm in London, I'm saying to myself, what do I do? I not choose exile. I said I never, nothing would ever take me from Kenya. This is what I'd said earlier. And now I've been told through the other channels that if I return home, a red carpet was awaiting for me at the Jomo Kenyatta Airport. You know, and the red carpet had, you know, the color of a red? the color of red was waiting for me at the airport. So I stayed on completely, you know. So I said to myself, I've already sworn to write my novels in Gikuyu language. I'm in London. Gikuyu speakers in London were minimal. I mean, maybe me and a few others, you know. Huh? How can I hold on to my pledge? Right, it was a very big challenge. So when I wrote the novel Matigari, the main character means survivor, really, Matigari survivor. It was more a test to myself. Can I hold on to this pledge now that the conditions are even more unfavorable in some ways, as far as writing Nico is concerned, than even when I was in Kenya, okay? So when I wrote the novel, Matigari, this is a character, by the way. This one, please, you asked about parallels. This is a character written in London in 1984, 85, because it came out. It's a character who goes around the country asking, because in a country, facts, the ministry of truth, which changes facts, become fiction. I mean, there's no way of telling fact, because what's fact is true. I mean, you know, so he goes around the country asking, just ask everybody, teachers, students, just ask a simple question, where can I find truth and justice in this country? Because everything which was truth has been turned into every people thought that people was facts. Anyway, so I was writing this in 1982, 1983, 1984, thereabout, because it came out in 1987 in Kenya, in Gikuyu language. This was a period when the rumor mongering in the country had been banned. And he was a character. And when people talk about books, they don't talk about the writer. You know, I mean, they talk about the character. Like films, People don't always talk about directors. They talk about the hero of the film and so on. So they are talking about Matigari as a character going around the country asking questions, you know, at a time when such questions were banned, okay? So they thought he was a real, the president thought he was a real living person. So they sent police warrant for his arrest. Yeah, okay, that's what she's referring to.
Yeah.
When they found that he, Matigari, was only a character in the novel, right, that's when the novel was arrested instead. Yeah. There was a kind of Operation Matigari. They went around the whole country. Police in civilian clothes would come to a bookshop, place like Barclay Bookshop or something. It is one called that way. They would say, oh, this book is very popular. We have finished. I'm a bookseller from neighboring. I finished all the stock. Show me what you have. I like to buy the stock you have. And of course, they are very happy. They bring all the books, and then they show their, police badge. Mm. That's how the novel came later to be arrested, not only from all the bookshops, but also they went to publish a warehouse and collected everything.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah. That's the background to the story, yeah.
I'm afraid we don't have more time, but we will be signing books, and these books are free. Not monetarily free, but free from imprisonment.
Yeah.
And if you would like, Professor Wationgo will be signing in the lobby, and I strongly recommend that you stick around and ask him any questions that you still have. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this podcast from the 2018 Bay Area Book Festival. For more podcasts, please go to www.baybookfest.org.